Support for podcasting on KBIA comes from Grindstone Fitness Studio, a full-service gym offering equipment for traditional exercise like weight and cardiovascular training, as well as specialized classes. Choices include personal training, spinning, yoga, Pilates, and more. All classes taught by certified professionals. More information is available at 443-4447, Grindstone Fitness Studio, 3005 Chinaberry Drive in Columbia.
From the Missouri School of Journalism, welcome to Global Journalist. I'm David Reed. November 15th is a big day for Brazil. It's celebrated as the Proclamation of the Republic, when Brazilian army officers overthrew Emperor Dom Pedro, and the monarchy came to an end. So it seems fitting that on November 15th this year, on Brazil's Independence Day, the country's biggest corruption case came to an end. The Mensalão scandal surfaced back in 2005, and it took this long to finally put a dozen corrupt politicians and executives in jail. The timing also coincides with Brazil's efforts to clean up its image before two of the world's most widely viewed sporting events come to the South American country. Brazil will host soccer's World Cup next summer, and 2 years later, the country will host the Summer Olympics. On today's program, I'm joined by Marina DeMartini, our producer and a native Brazilian, and we'll talk with two scholars about the state of journalism, corruption, and social activism in Brazil. Our guests today are Anthony Pereira, who directs the Brazil Institute at King's College in London, and Paulo Sotero. He directs the Brazil Institute of the Wilson International Center for Scholars in Washington. Welcome to Global Journalist.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
Yeah, I'm glad to have you. Paulo, could you give us a synopsis of the Mensalão case?
This is the largest corruption trial ever seen in Brazil. It starts in 2005 during the government of President Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva, a very popular leader. His chief of staff and some other prominent members of the Workers' Party, some congressmen, some bankers and associates are involved in a scandal, in a denunciation by one of the participants, a congressman by the name Roberto Jefferson, that the government had constructed a scheme of vote-buying Congress to ensure that they would have the support of a majority in matters of interest to the administration. Once this was revealed, it became obviously headline news for weeks. It took about 7 years for the judiciary system to prepare the trial. The trial took place in 2012. It was carried on live television, and there were 37 people indicted. 25 were found guilty, more than a dozen sentenced to jail terms. This was a first in Brazil, and just recently, on November 15th, Brazil's National Day, the Chief Justice in Brazil of Brazil, Joaquim Barbosa, ordered those who were found guilty and sentenced to jail to start serving their prison terms. This was unexpected, and I think very well received in Brazil, a country known for its culture of impunity of those in positions of power. And now you have those people in jail serving their terms in Brazil. And personally, I think Brazil is better off for that event.
And Anthony, one area of your research is Brazil's political, economic, and social transformation in the 20th and early 21st century. How important is this corruption case and the way it's turned out?
Well, I think it's very important. Paulo is right that a lot of people were, I think, pleasantly surprised that this happened, because in I was in Brazil in September when it seemed that the opposite was happening, where the judges voted for it was a sort of appeal by the convicted defendants in the Mensalão case, in which it looked like they were going to have the right to a whole other procedure, a sort of retrial, if you like, before facing sentences. And so this short-circuited that possibility. And there was a lot of indignation in September when it looked like they would stay out of prison for a long time through that recourse. I think the question is, you know, one of the interesting questions is, will this lead, will this have a ripple effect? Will this lead to more teeth, if you will, to other anti-corruption investigations? Because there are plenty of investigations in Brazil, and there are a lot of institutions of accountability, and yet when it comes to white collar crime or corruption crime, it's often very hard to actually convict and get people to prison. And so, you know, I think it's an open question whether this will lead to more of the similar outcomes.
Okay. The other case I wanted to talk about just briefly is this summer, a congressman named Nathan Donadon was jailed for embezzling public money. The Economist reports that he is the first lawmaker in the country in more than three decades to be locked up while still in office. Is this conviction also a signal of an anti-corruption trend? For Paulo, if you can answer first.
I believe it is, and it happens, David, in the wake of the June mass protest in the streets of Brazil. I think people were saying in the streets that they were really exasperated with this culture of tolerance with corrupt people, that they want more, better services. They want a government that works and that focuses on their needs, rather than a Congress and politicians that are basically seen as a self-serving class of people in Brazil. So both the Donadon case and the sentencing, the jailing of those found guilty in the Mensalão, I think were directly connected with this outburst of anger in Brazilian streets and telling the government, you guys, behave yourselves and, you know, respond to our demands. And one of the demands is for more decency in society, in a work, a government that is more responsive to people's demands.
Okay. And Anthony, I want you to comment on the Donadon case and then talk about the, the protests and your interesting class you had today.
Yeah, I think Paulo is right that the Donadon decision had a lot to do with the protests, and because the protests got the politicians to start to walk on eggshells. They were very, very nervous about getting bad public opinion, because the charges against Donadon go back, I think, something like 19 years. I mean, it was a case that could have been acted upon a lot earlier. And so it stimulated this kind of response.
Yeah, just to give the viewers, the audience, an idea of this, it was $3.6 million he embezzled by faking contracts with a shell advertising firm between 95 and 98 while he was working for the legislature in the northern state of Brazil. And so tell me about this class you had today, talking about the protests. What were the students saying?
It was interesting. It started off with a video and a presentation by a British PhD student who'd been in Rio, and then it was another student who'd been in Salvador. And one of the things we got out of those two presentations was how different the protests were in those two cities. I mean, at the height of the protest, June 20th, 2013, there were estimates of 1.5 million people in the streets and over 350 cities being affected by protests. And so I think, you know, our images tend to come from big cities like Sao Paulo and Rio and Brasilia. But in fact, there were the huge variation in terms of what motivated people, I think, what people were demanding, how they communicated with each other in order to go out into the streets. And so I think there's a real variation in people's experiences with this. And there were, you know, dozens of different demands being made at the time.
What is interesting about this, the city that I was born in, Brazil, they have like 80,000 people living there, and around like 10,000 people went to the streets to protest about everything that is going on in Brazil now.
It's a huge percentage.
Yeah, yeah. We had another student who'd been in Novo Friburgo in the Região Serrana of Rio de Janeiro, and they had very big protests that were partly about the response to the mudslides that had occurred 2 years earlier. So it was about things that the authorities hadn't done at the time of this natural disaster. It's interesting what you're saying about your town having its own specific sort of sets of demands.
What's your opinion, Paulo? I'll start with you about whether these protests might resume once the attention of the world is on Brazil and the World Cup begins in June.
I think it is to be expected in a sense, because very cleverly people involved in those protests saw in doing the tournament that prepared for the World Cup exercise in June of 2003, an opportunity to voice their demands, did it in many ways with good humor, and I think those will come back probably. The World Cup will be hosted in 12 capitals around Brazil from mid-June to mid-July. And I think there is an expectation in some politicians like Marina Silva, who was seen a former senator, former minister of Lula, who is seen as the main political beneficiary or the spokesperson for that sort of insatisfaction voice in the streets, has actually told and predicted that the protests will return.
Mm-hmm. Anthony, do you have anything to add?
Yeah, there was an interesting survey done by Ibope, polling company, on the 20th of June, of protesters in 8 different cities. And the interesting thing about that poll was that only 5% of those surveyed said that they were their principal motivation in protesting was against overspending for the World Cup. So I think Paula's right. There may well be protests, but partly because it's just a wonderful opportunity for protesters, because the eyes of the world will be on Brazil. And I think that was part of the reason why the Confederations Cup was the time when people protested in June, July of this year. So we disagreed about this in the class. What some of my students were saying, they didn't think that there would be protests for the World Cup. But I'm sort of expecting that there will be. But it won't necessarily mean that everyone is protesting is against the World Cup per se. But they want, as Paulo's been saying, they want better services. They want better public transportation, better schools, better hospitals, and they want a more accountable and cleaner government.
And do you think that this protest will continue during the Olympics? Because it's a huge difference between the World Cup and the Olympics. The World Cup is more related to the culture of soccer in Brazil. Do you think that's kind of different?
They're very different tournaments. I mean, yeah, the Olympics is in Rio. Yeah, really hard to say. I mean, that's sort of 2.5 years out. So, yeah, I think it'd be risky to predict what might happen.
Yeah,
in 2016.
I think, Anthony, it will depend on what happens in these 2 years. You know, I think that officials in Brazil, people in government, judges, they will have an opportunity to act, to continue this mobilization against corruption, and let's see what happens. For instance, with the implementation of vast investments on infrastructure projects. If those go well, I think people will be satisfied. I don't think people want to protest against the government for the sake of protest. Brazilians are very practical. I think people want to protest to achieve, to get some response, and if they get the response, they will be happy. They will protest about something else. It's a democracy. You know, free expression is important, and it's part, in a sense, of the national conversation in Brazil.
And coverage of Olympics starts several years ahead of time, as you say, with the controversies over public spending for the stadiums and such. And also, like in Sochi right now in Russia, Russia is getting a lot of criticism from the outside by the way it's treating journalists who are coming into the country to report on the state of the region and preparation for the Olympics. So I could see how that they could happen fairly soon.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I hope so that happens, actually, as a Brazilian, of course.
Speaking of accountability, let's look at the connection between investigative journalism and corruption. In the latest report on freedom of the press in Brazil, the media advocacy group Freedom House points out that the country has a vibrant democracy with strong constitutional guarantees of freedom of expression, and Brazil has a new law that allows more public access to information. But Freedom House points out that journalists now are frequently harassed, attacked, and even killed for their work, and have to deal with troubling acts of judicial censorship. So Paulo, the Freedom of Information Law has been in effect for a year and a half now. Tell us a bit about the law and whether it's working to make public officials more accountable.
Yeah, it has been used, especially for newspapers in São Paulo, Rio, and Brasília. This is where the press is mostly developed in Brazil. Freedom of the press does exist in São Paulo, in Rio, in those major cities. In the countryside, obviously, where elites, traditional elites, still rule, it's more difficult. That's where most of those acts of violence against journalists take place, although there has been some horrible acts in Rio connected with victimizing journalists that were involved in investigative journalism against drug cartels and things like that. But I believe that, you know, again, there is a mobilization. There is a very active association of Brazilians that specialize in investigative journalism. They are internationally connected. And Brazil is a country that, contrary to Russia, et cetera, you know, this business of the image of Brazil abroad, it really doesn't bother people. We are a Western country, tropical but Western, and people are connected and want to, you know, tell what the country, what is happening in the country. I don't think most people are bothered by this. Investigative journalism is a reality, obviously. As in other countries, journalism in Brazil is changing from the traditional media to the online media. The Brazilian journalism, traditional journalism, face the same challenges it faces in the United States and other countries. But I think the contribution of investigative journalism in Brazil is very important.
Mm-hmm. Anthony?
Yeah, I think there's good investigative journalism in Brazil. There's also what some academics call journalism about investigations. So journalists will cover investigations by the public ministry, which is a kind of autonomous investigative prosecutorial branch of government. They'll investigate congressional investigations. They'll report on other investigations being made. And I think watchdog groups are important in this respect as well. I talked last night to a guy from Transparency International here in London, and he said that they work with local groups in Brazil, but they encourage them not to point fingers at individuals. As Paulo said, this can be dangerous, especially in small towns in the countryside, but simply to draw attention to problems of regulation, public procurement, government spending. So they encourage the people they work with not to individualize these things and expose themselves to possible retaliation, which can happen in some of the smaller places, and I think that's a responsible way to organize sort of anti-corruption movements.
And Anthony, can you talk about the ninja media, these young journalists, citizen journalists, and their role?
Yeah, my students mentioned ninja media today, and I have to confess that I don't know the site and I don't know how it works, but I think Paula's right. There is a new sort of hybrid form, and I think the transmission goes both ways. So the people on Twitter and on Ninja Media, on Facebook, will use content produced by the traditional media, but the traditional media is also picking up content that's produced, by citizen journalists, if you like, or citizen activists, and so they'll film things, and those will find their way onto the traditional media. So I think it is a new form. I think what that form is quite effective at doing is helping people organize, for example, in the protests of June, July of this year, and also protesting. The one concrete concession that governments made in the June, July protests was, of course, rolling back the bus fares by 20 cents. I think it's harder for that new media to be a vehicle for concrete proposals. It functions better as a kind of watchdog, denunciatory medium.
Mm-hmm. Media is a sort of, in the United States, I think it's called civic journalism, you know. It's mm-hmm. some sort of participatory journalism. Their claim to fame was to be in the streets and doing live coverage of confrontations between police and protesters and between police and the black blocs, which are people described by some as anarchists, by some as fascists, that in the end got involved into this. I think the ninja media played an important role, like the what we call the alternative media in Brazil during the time of the dictatorship. I believe, though, that their capacity to stay involved is quite limited. I believe the traditional media has already organized itself to next time there is a similar protest in Brazil, this sort of burst of anger demands. I think the traditional media will be prepared to respond and to inform people, notwithstanding, you know, the role of new media that is now used also and increasingly by traditional media.
Do you think that people are relying more on social media because there is a belief in Brazil that most of the traditional media is corrupted?
I think, you know, as a journalist myself, I think this belief is completely exaggerated. What there is, and indeed that is true, there is, like in the United States, like I believe in England and other countries, there is a concentration of ownership of media. The fact that the idea that most major newspapers and television stations, etc., are corrupt, to me, is a difficult case to make. Obviously, you have the connections between local powerful family of politicians and media in certain places, especially in the more remote places, the interior of Brazil. That is correct. But I believe I would not generalize. I think the Brazilian media has been an important actor in the redemocratization of Brazil in the 70s and 80s and remains a vital participant in this democracy we have in Brazil.
And Anthony, I want you to weigh in on the role of the traditional media in this concentration issue. But let me break. We have to, before we continue this discussion, I want to remind everyone that you can view or listen to this program anytime by downloading our podcast at globaljournalist.org. You can also find interesting articles, photos, and interviews related to our program on our website. This week we have a slideshow of Brazilians convicted of corruption and articles about media censorship and the link to corruption and a historical look at the culture of corruption. We also have an infographic on how corruption affects the population. So please send us questions or comments via globaljournalist@kbia.org or our Facebook page. You can also follow us on Twitter at globaljourn. So Anthony, the traditional press, now the concentration in Brazil is very high, right? It's like 10 families control a huge percentage of the media. Is that right?
It's high, but it varies. There's a very interesting table in a new book called Making Brazil Work by Carlos Pereira and Marcos Melo. And they show that it's a table on ownership of media by politicians. Mm-hmm. And it's very, very high in the north and the northeast. In some states, it's as high as 80%. But as you go to the southeast and the south, it actually becomes quite low, and the private sector is, there's still a concentration of media, but what they're looking at is members of the political class owning the media, and there's more of a separation in the southeast and the south. But Paulo can correct me if I'm wrong, but I think Brazil is a country where newspaper circulation is actually going up, not down. Mm-hmm. But I would say, I don't have scientific evidence about that, but I sense that young people are more skeptical about traditional media than older people. They're less likely to habitually read a newspaper. They're less likely to only get their news from traditional media. And I think that's not just in Brazil. That's in lots of other countries as well. There are people who want they want to be more selective about the information they get. They want to shape their own consumption of the media to a greater extent than, say, a simple newspaper reader does. And so I think they're going to, you know, continue to use these other outlets to use social media and to spread information amongst themselves.
And that this, Anthony, has to do with also the problematic business model of traditional media. Traditional media wants to use new media in order to reach more people, but they cannot do it for free. They want to charge for that, and that obviously will make younger people go for alternative places where they can get information without paying. This is a dilemma in the United States. This is a dilemma in most countries. Now, I believe that well-informed young people in Brazil find a way of accessing both new media. There are some blogs, some sites that are very good quality journalism, and also at the same time continue to access traditional media, but as you point out, in a selective way. This will continue because we are in transition here. We don't know precisely where the media, how media will look like 15 years from now. And this generation growing up now in Brazil, in England, in the United States, all over the world, will determine, you know, will answer that question.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And one last question we can get into. Will the creation of this national forum on the judiciary and media freedom that came into existence last year, do you think that will lead to better court decisions affecting freedom of information?
I'm not sure about that. I really don't know so much about that institution, but I do know that the Freedom of Information Act is working in certain cases. I have two academics that I know use the Freedom of Information Act to get information on the loans that the development bank, the BNDES, was making because they had not made this, they previously had not made it public. And they were able to get this new law to function in their particular case. And I know that the Truth Commission, which is working in Brazil, is also making use of the Freedom of Information mm-hmm. law to get declassified documents. So, I mean, I think there is a climate mm-hmm. in Brazil of sort of demands for greater accountability, greater openness. And so I would imagine that this institution would be part of that general shift, but I'm not aware of the specific activities that they've been engaged in.
Okay.
Yeah, but going in the direction opposite to what Anthony was describing, there is, David, something that you mentioned with the judicialization of freedom of information mm-hmm. in Brazil, of decisions, court decisions that have tended to hurt or to affect mm-hmm. freedom of expression in Brazil. There are some famous cases, and here is where I believe you need to more discussions, because there is a contradiction in the Brazilian Constitution regarding this. Brazilian Constitution says that prior censorship is absolutely not allowed in Brazil, but at the same time, it says that people have the right to protect their own themselves against slandering by media, etc., etc. And it's up to judges, to politicians, to society, to debate and to put those two things together. We, for instance, do not have the notion of the what is a public figure in Brazil, like you have, obviously, in the United States. A public figure has a very much higher standard to fulfill in order to protect itself from negative news in media. We don't have that. Recently, some people that are heroes to my generation, like musicians, composers, have started a movement trying to prevent biographers of publishing books about themselves without their prior consent. Right. It's to me, that's nonsense. But, you know, people that really wrote the soundtrack of my generation are now involved in what I think is prior censorship. It's a debate that we have to have in Brazil, and I think that we will have in Brazil in the coming years.
Okay, well, we'll have to leave it there. And it's been a fascinating discussion. I really appreciate you two taking the time to enlighten us on what's happening in Brazil. And I'm sure the country's going to be in the news in the coming months quite a bit.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you. Pleasure to be with you.
Thanks.
Global Journalist is produced by the Reynolds Journalism Institute and the Missouri School of Journalism. Joining us today was Anthony Pereira from the Brazil Institute at King's College and Paulo Sotero from the Brazil Institute of the Wilson International Center for Scholars. Global Journalist is directed by Travis McMillan, audio by Pat Akers. Raymond Tungerkar is our executive producer. Marina DiMartini was this week's lead producer. Please join us again next week for another Global Journalist. I'm David Reed.